after the police got here. See, that girl Amanda told the police, I ain't just the only ones. It's some more girls up in that house. So they went up there, you know, 30, 40 deep, and when they came out, was just astonishing, because I thought they were going to come up with nothing, because we see this dude every day. Right. I barbecue with this dude. We eat ribs and whatnot and listen to salsa music. You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah. And you had no indication that there was anything going on?
Bro, not a clue that that girl was in that house or anybody else was in there against their will.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Because how he is he just comes out to his backyard, plays with the dogs, tinker with his cars and motorcycles, goes back in the house. So he's somebody that you look away because he's not doing nothing but the average stuff. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. There's nothing exciting about him. Well, until today.
Another interesting case that stood out to me, because it's really one of the more unique cases of the 28. I mean, they're all sort of unique in their own sense, but this one was stood out from all of them because this is sort of a rare male-on-male case, adult male-on-male, not something where someone's taking advantage of a child. This is the Dustin LaFortune case. I guess, tell me more about this case, because I'm still puzzled by this one. You know, we talk about the Tanya Koch case. I guess the suspicion in a lot of ways is, was there like a romantic element involved here between Dustin LaFortune and his captor? Or what was the bond that kept him in captivity with this guy? Because he wasn't necessarily chained up like some of these other victims. It was a mental bondage in a way. Talk about the Dustin LaFortune case. Enlighten me to what went down with that one. That one takes place in Canada. So, as I said, we're spanning the globe here with these stories.
Yeah, Dustin LaFortune and Dustin Paxton couldn't have been more different. Dustin LaFortune had come from, you know, a clean living family that didn't watch television or that didn't have sugar, whereas Dustin Paxton was someone who had been in trouble and put into state care since the age of 12, and these two had become friends a few years earlier and then decided they were going to move to Regina in Canada and start their own business, like a moving business. And their household there became sort of, you know, the party household with lots of drinking, and it seems like there's a lot of methamphetamine is going on as well.
Right, that's so, the other part I want to ask you about, because the people, there's two schools of thought here. As I said, I forgot about that other element where it's like people wonder how this went down. It's like, was there a romantic element or some kind of drugs? Was there drugs involved? So that now you're kind of cluing me in. Maybe it was more drug related, perhaps. But go on. I'm sorry.
Well, it could have been drug related. I couldn't work out the sexual nature of the case because Dustin LaFortune was horribly beaten. When they found him, he looked nothing like the young man that he went in as. He had many broken ribs, his eye sockets were broken, his lips had been beaten off, and his legs had been whipped so many times that flesh was starting to decay on them, and he was dumped in front of the hospital, and it wasn't expected that he would survive. And part of the way he would avoid getting beatings was to perform sexual favours on Dustin Paxman, and that was one of the main charges that Paxman got, was that he had aggravated sexual assault. So he wasn't found guilty of unlawful confinement, and even though he seemed to have an ultimate control over LaFortune, because the judge said that they need to understand why he didn't leave, why Dustin LaFortune didn't leave. That there is a difference between domination and confinement. And LaFortune said that he didn't realise how he was being manipulated and seemed like a very gentle person. And in the end, he didn't want to be seen as though he was a sissy, because Paxton was a fellow that was actually much smaller than him, but a lot more aggressive.
Hmm.
So there's a large sexual element. This raises another interesting point about most cases when you're released, you hear that there are females being released. And my theory on that is the reason you don't hear of more males being released, is particularly if things are of a sexual nature, males don't tend to have the physicality to stand up to sustain sexual abuse the way females do. Because particularly, say, if the, much raping, the way a man gets raped is quite different, which, mainly would lead to, problems like with septicemia, with the blood being poisoned through the tearing of the bowels. And so I think that it's much more difficult for males to survive, being held captive.
Oh, God.
And that's why we have a lot more female, the males would just die. I think the males would just die earlier. And so they wouldn't be held for an extended period of time.
Oh, that's horrifying, because the implication there then is that it has happened. So, you know.
Yeah, it's probably more likely to come out, you know, it probably wouldn't last as long, or wouldn't last for years. It would just last maybe for a few weeks, and it would just be, you know.
Oh, my God, yeah. So if there's if this is happening, there's probably some dude that's got like a whole bunch of bodies in his backyard and one unfortunate dude still hanging on in the basement right now. Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, that's scary.
That's my theory on it.
So he just, it's still mind-boggling in a way though, the case, because he did have the opportunity to leave, and you just want, it's a mental domination. It's bizarre. It really is, it's really bizarre that he wouldn't just fight back against this guy who was beating on him. He goes against human nature almost.
Yeah, it seems like you know, this ultimate control, and just not wanting to be seen as though he was weak. And he just didn't seem to. I think the manipulation happened over a long period of time. So it's just abuse abuse is increasing often. I guess it's like a domestic violence situation. If you start off, you know, with small abuses which get larger and larger, then you would often wonder, you know, before she was murdered, why didn't this woman leave? And you go, well, you know, things just aren't, you know, always cut and dry, because there's, you know, there's financial, they had financial involvement with each other as well. So I don't know whether they're in a relationship or whether he wanted to be in, Dustin Paxton wanted to be in a relationship with a fortune, but didn't know how to express it. But he did take on in one of his police interviews that he always, as many people do, who hold people, is that they say, no, I was caring for him. He didn't know how to look after himself, or I had to be responsible for him. He kept doing these things to himself, and if I wasn't there, it would have ended up much worse.
I was going to ask you, what is this guy's justification, this Dustin Paxton? What's his justification for doing this, that this guy was incompetent and he was doing it to himself?
Yeah.
Jesus.
He was too naive to be able to look after himself properly, so I needed to do it, and this is, you know, and he did it, he was doing this, you know, he was asking for it, or he was doing it to himself, so.
Oh.
Yeah, that's quite horrific. But he may pull his life back together, and hopefully he does very well for himself. He seems like a very nice person, Dustin the Fortune. So I hope the best for him.
Absolutely. And I should, I guess I'll mention it. There's a if you Google Dustin LaFortune, folks, there's a horrifying picture of what he looked like when they found him. And it's just, if you want to really understand the sheer horrifying aspect of this case, just Google Dustin LaFortune, and you'll see the pictures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You need a strong stomach for that picture. That's quite horrific.
Yeah, absolutely, folks. Fair warning. Don't go unless you want to see this, because it's not something for the faint of heart. Now, another case. Now, prepare yourself, because this one's going to be a bit complex, but it's, in a way, it was funny, because I'm reading the book. This is the Linda Weston case. Originally, she's left in charge of her mother dies. I think the father's out of the picture, and this is like in Philadelphia. I don't know why Philadelphia seems to draw these these crimes, but so at the age of 19, she's left in charge of this family, and just starts abusing them and doing horrible things to her younger siblings, and along the way they keep someone captive in like a cupboard for years, and then she ends up going to jail for this. She gets out and then goes on this insane spree of kidnappings and human trafficking in a way, and just horrifying, horrifying things. And as I'm reading the book, you know, she's like one of the first cases in the book. Then she's also one of the last cases in the book. And you know, I'm reading it, and I'm like, wait a minute, is this, I thought I read about Alinda Weston already. You know, and I flip back, and it's the same lady. It's really mind-blowing, this case, because this woman has just a string of insane acts. Multiple victims, multiple states, multiple years. You know, if somebody wants to win an Academy Award, play this woman in a movie. You almost certainly will, because what a complex, bizarre individual. Tell me about, or tell the folks at home a little bit, about Linda Weston and this strange case.
Yeah, like this, almost over 30 years, Linda Weston was, you know, set free across Philadelphia. And she, yeah, she killed Bernardo Ramos, which is almost a story almost forgotten about. She locked him in a cupboard until he eventually died. They dumped him in a convent, a disused convent in the streets of Philadelphia. And he already had four children. She went up to prison, but then was released a few years later. And when she was, all her, you know, all the signs were there earlier on about what would come later. She would drug her siblings so that they wouldn't cause trouble. But then she would also send her younger siblings and cousins, some as young as 11, out to prostitute in order to make her money. The house was racked with incest from a very young age. And part of that was because Linda Weston wanted to get her siblings impregnated so that she could collect more Social Security welfare payments from the government.
Right, right.
So that sort of set her up for later in life. The more children she had, the more payments she could get. She also preyed on people with disability. So there was quite a number of them, and to avoid detection, she'd move from state to state. And she'd pick up co-conspirators along the way that have, you know, she picked a disabled person up. She'd look after them. She often hung around outside hospitals and look for people who were, you know, being released for psychiatric care. And she would befriend them on the way out and say, we've got a place where you can come stay. And through this, she could collect people's Social Security payments.
Right,
and
right.
So for her, it was the more the better. And this, it's really untold about how many victims she actually had. But she tends to be probably the worst in the sheer size of her crime. And someone who seems, you know, of low IQ, mentally ill, she seemed to be very, very smart about it and knew exactly how to manipulate people and to get people's trust.
Yeah.
And to get them to hand over anything they wanted. She also held her, you know, her children, one, her son, Joseph McIntosh, in the basement for over a year until he managed to escape. And she left, there was two women who died. The police didn't recognize them as murders. They just seemed like people who had sort of decayed under their own conditions, you know, natural causes.
Right.
When their bodies were found, one lady almost had no toes left and they'd popped up in front of the television with piles of pills to make it look like she'd sort of wasted away and overdosed on her own doing. And another lady fell through an attic ceiling, and she was then locked in a cupboard until she eventually died on the laundry floor. And again, just given, you know, a pile of pills sat next to her, and, you know, and the police were like, okay, she just died of natural causes. Let's not into it. Let's not look into it too much. And then it just moved state, and then just moved state, and then continue kidnapping people along the way and getting her other, you know, her siblings to help with the kidnapping and torturing. And this case is still going too, so you probably want to look forward to, and I'll look out for when this case goes ahead. It's meant to be going ahead sometime this year, but it could be quite a while off, I would suspect. She has avoided the death penalty, but recently there was a payout, a civil case done against her, which was where one of the people who kidnapped were to be paid out $45 million.
Oh my God!
So yeah, it's unlikely they'll ever see the money.
Yeah,
but it was a matter of just trying to hold them accountable. And yeah, the case will come up. It's a federal indictment, and it should be interesting to see what Linda Ann Weston actually receives from it. If she had the death penalty revoked, it won't be happening. So, and also the first person to be federally indicted under the Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Hate Crime Prevention Act as well. So it'll be interesting to see the test case to see how that plays out.
Interesting. Yeah, it's remarkable. So there's a good chance then, because I was going to say, it's remarkable that folks don't know about Linda Weston yet. Given the way the media is, you would think this case would be all over the place. So there's a good chance once this kind of heats up some more and goes to trial, that everybody in America is going to hear about the Linda Weston case then.
Yeah, there's just the scope of it. It's quite amazing that it isn't as well known. That considering the scope of it over 30 years, it's quite, you know, it seems like it should be bigger than it is, but it's sort of, as some cases do, they fade away. There was also one just after the Cleveland girls were released, where four people were found in Texas, Austin, Texas, and they were found locked in a garage, and like Linda Weston, they were, you know, being used for their social security benefits, and there's four men, but there's also four other women in the house over time. And that case sort of broke, and then just a few months after Cleveland, but then it just sort of petered away again quite quickly. So it's amazing, some cases catch our attention, some cases don't, and we don't find out what happens in the end, a lot of them.
Right. It could say a lot about the way the media is here in America that one of the big reasons I think that the Cleveland case was so huge was that it was a young white girl that went missing, because these kind of things may happen more often in these urban areas and it doesn't become news as much.
Yeah, well, I'm not quite sure how it all works over there. I guess Linda Weston no one there was white. And neither was the Austin, Texas one. So, and even, I guess, I can't remember the name of the fellow that found the Cleveland girls, you know, said when a pretty young girl runs into a black man's arms, you know, something's wrong. They made that the song out of. Interesting though. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what to make of that one, because I have a bit of a different culture over here, so.
Right.
So, yeah, and also we haven't had a real case like this in Australia either, so not yet, not that we're aware of. Only the Natasha Ryan who turned out not to, self-imposed. She's another one.
Interesting, yeah, so Australia hasn't had an Ariel Castro-type case yet, so. Yeah.
No, not at all.
Now, the last case I have here from the cherry-picked ones, and then we'll probably just kind of chat a little bit more about the phenomenon in general, is Li Hao, and that's in China. And what I found really... We talk about sort of the cultural differences here with these cases. What I thought was really interesting is that he has a series of girls in his captivity, and at some point along the way... He makes I don't recall if it's three or four girls, but he makes the remaining girls kill one of the other girls. I think perhaps to implicate them in the crime or just to further advance his control over them. But then the remarkable part culturally is that after it all goes down and he's captured and he goes on trial and everything, even though they were given reduced sentences or maybe even no sentences at all, the other victims still face charges for killing the fellow victim, despite the fact that they were forced to do it by Li Hao during their captivity. It's really like, wow, what a country, man. What a way to live, that you're still charged with that, despite the circumstances. So I guess talk a little bit about that weird cultural aspect of it.
Yeah, it is quite strange. Many of them spent a few months in prison because... under Chinese law, it said that they participated in the murders of other women who were held captive, and they were murdered as a sign of to show favor, you know, to get favoritism from Li Hao. So they'd often fight about who would have sex with him, and then punish the other, you know, punish the weaker woman. And he was one of the disturbing things about that case was the women then had to live in a bunker that was underneath their building, dug out of dirt. But he into the floor. That's where he put the bodies and left them in the corner. So there's two bodies rotting in the basement while the other women were living in there. And he dragged the other women up and made them perform sex acts on the internet. And that was a way of, you know, him getting income. And yeah, Li Hao has now been put to death. I believe he was spent through executed by firing squad. Yeah, that was very strange. Culturally, it's very difficult to understand. And the victims of it were also, you know, imprisoned for, you know, something that they really had no choice of enduring. It doesn't appear that China has, you know, much sympathy for prostitutes. The women tended to come from karaoke bars and willing to come back to his premises to involve themselves in sex acts and get paid for it. So I think that may have influenced the decision that, you know, these weren't, you know, pure women and therefore, you know, didn't need to be treated with any great amount of respect. Yeah, it's very bizarre, but it's just, I guess it's the way that China decided to, you know, work the case. I find it difficult understanding it myself.
Yeah, it's strange. It really is strange.
And the women weren't also allowed to have any legal representation while they're on trial as well. So it doesn't seem like, you know, they really got anything out of it. They got, you know, no great amount of assistance at all. And I wouldn't imagine that, going back into society, but, you know, there wasn't going to be much, you know, aftercare. There tends to be a bit coming out of China. I've come across a few cases of people held captive in China. The one that Li Hao holding sex slaves in a dugout basement, and that's just completely rare. That just completely blew the country away. But there are other cases that are coming out where in China, family members have been holding disabled relatives in cages or cells or by chains for number of years or decades, and particularly in urban areas or out in the mountain areas, you know, where care is not really available for people with mental illness or other type of illnesses. So they're just sort of left for the family to look after them, and having no idea. But there's several cases that come out of the last few years where that has been occurring.
Weird. You know, again, that goes to the whole idea that we've seen throughout these cases and stuff that a lot of times it seems to be like a family member doing it to a weaker member of the family, you know, a parent doing it.
Mm.
Again, I like I said, we've kind of hit all the cherry-picked cases, and maybe we can dive sort of into sort of the more nebulous nature of all this, or maybe the deeper aspect of it. Mm. I guess, what do you think? I don't know. It boggles my mind. It's hard to get into the mind of these people, first of all. It's really hard to understand the motivation. But, I mean, what do you make of the aspect of the phenomenon where it's parents who just keep their child captive like that? Because it happens, you know, throughout the book.
Yeah, there's, I think there's just a lot of family shame that goes on. David Bisson's parents, mother kept him, you know, hidden away because she was a child that she never really wanted, so she kept him hidden away. There's one from Italy, there's two from Italy, actually, and they were both the same thing, where people who had disabilities were held captive by their family and locked away. It's generally through disability of not being able to understand how to cope with it, or believing it shows a family shame, or there tend to be the more perverse incest aspect, such as the Joseph Fritzl case, where he held his daughter in a purpose-built dungeon for 24 years. And that insidious nature, sort of psychopathic nature of just wanting absolute control over someone and having a secret that's so big that, you know, that no one else can find out about it, no one else can control what's going on.
It's troubling. It's very weird. You wonder what goes into the minds of these people. You know something, David? I don't know about you, but I can barely keep my own life together. Talk about trying to have a double life. Like, I don't know how these... They're remarkably evil, industrious people, which I think is kind of... That's like the scariest part. It's not like there's some dude who picks up a hooker and kills her. Well, obviously, that person's evil. This is someone who takes the time to build a dungeon and then keep them captive or try to keep people captive, as the case... there's a case from the book in Germany where this guy builds an elaborate sort of S&M dungeon sort of layout, if you will, yeah, and tries to kidnap the girl, but then she escapes, like, immediately. But the point is, you know, it's crazy the amount of work, time, effort, thought that these people put into these scenarios.
Yeah, some and years going into preparing for it, particularly in the Russian cases. They spent about 4 years each just digging their dungeon. And a lot, you know, other cases they spend planning it. Some people, they just have a room. But just thinking that, you know, they put in years of their life to go, I'm going to hold someone for years. Yeah, it's quite extraordinary that people would think that way and sort of not consider, you know, that the other person actually has a life or has an empathy. It's like, you know, people who go stalking, I don't understand stalking because how do you find so much time to do something? You know, in comparison, stalking would be such a minor crime compared to holding someone captive for years. But even that doesn't even, you know, just, you know, general domestic stalking tends to take over people's lives and they just put all their time and effort into it. And, but this is, you know, this is just extreme. And I guess that's why it sort of, you know, it captures everyone's attention when it does happen, when we find out about it, that someone has actually gone to such an extreme far beyond what is, you know, the comprehension of most people.
I know it's an impossible thing to speculate about, but I'm going to have to ask you anyway, because I've certainly given some thought. I mean, I think it's safe to say right now, talking, you and I, that right now there is someone in a situation that is depicted in the book going on right now. There are people being held captive as we speak, is the point I'm trying to make. Certainly not happening often. Certainly not like happening in every city in America. I hope not. But, I mean, how bad do you think this is? I think it's probably much worse than the public thinks.
Well, there tends to be, I've only looked at it from 1970 onwards and to now, to, you know, 2013. That was 28 major cases, plus there's other smaller ones that didn't make the book. But the time limit, I definitely think it's still occurring at this stage. And around the world, there is someone or a number of people who are being held and that we just don't know about. And it's only the rescued ones that we find out about as well. So along the way, there could have been other ones who had been held for 10 years, ended up dying in confinement, and their body or in the bunker or whatever was just buried. And we don't hear about those ones. So these are only the cases we know about. So I reckon that believes that there's, you know, many more that have occurred and that we'll never hear about, and there certainly will be more in the future. So I don't think it's going away, and it's just gonna be interesting to see the way that technology is played in it, because it seems to be more as it encompasses our life, and also, you know, it becomes, you know, more ingrained in, you know, the rescues or the case you were talking about in Germany where he had numbers of cameras set up and he was really watching the premises and so he could see outside and he had wire over his windows and it was quite obvious what was going on. But he used technology. He bought his a phone box off eBay and used that to hold a woman in so that he could impregnate her. But, you know, he forgot to lock the door, you know, right at the last moment, the last piece he forgot to do. and she managed to escape. So the technology is going to be interesting to see, and how, you know, internet reacts and we react as people, whether we, you know, it becomes, a comedy show, or, you know, we take how seriously we take it.
Well, thankfully, it seems like people take it pretty seriously, at least here, more than they did back in the day when they were shouting Alpo at the victims. It's ironic in a way, or it's illuminating in a sense. This connects to a previous edition of the program we did with Leslie Wagner Wilson, who escaped from Jonestown, and she was terrified of telling anyone that she had escaped from Jonestown when she got back to America, because the people were ridiculed and they were made fun of for being a part of the Jonestown thing. So and then you hear these stories about victims of the captivity case of Gary Heidnik, and the same kind of attitude is pervasive there, and almost a decade later too. It's scary that people were treated that way back then. Thankfully, it looks like they're treated better now, but who knows what happens in other countries. You know, we talked about the pervasive possible nature of this. You kind of alluded to it when you talked about women who don't have countries that don't have stellar track records for women's rights. I mean, I don't want to sound xenophobic or anything, folks, but like you pointed out with the women going missing in Africa, you can only imagine what kind of stuff happens in other parts of the country where women can just be taken captive, like some of the cases in this book, and it's perfectly okay. That's really scary.
Another thing also I found quite interesting is that with the people who are released, a lot of them don't actually seek psychiatric help or professional help at all. They just want to ignore all that. Like, some of them just want to walk straight back into their lives and be normal and go, look, I had an unpleasant experience. I don't want media around me anymore. I don't want to be analysed or used as a subject. And whereas other people who come out, obviously suffer significant trauma and their lives are never recover again. So it's just quite interesting the way they won't, I guess there's such a prevalence of psychology and stuff today that a lot of the captives just completely reject all that and just want to just walk away, and it'll also walk away from media attention as well.
And I'm sure there's also cases. We talked a little bit about, well, we talked about the Tanya Koch case, and it comes up also in the Colleen Stan case, where you wonder sort of if there's instances where Stockholm syndrome sort of sets in with these situations. Colleen Stan, she escapes, or she leaves the guy, but still keeps in touch 3 months, over the course of 3 months. She doesn't go running to the police and say, I was held in a box under this dude's bed for 3 years. Like, why? You know, it's amazing. She still contacts him for the 3 months after she leaves. I guess talk a little bit, we'll circle back around to the Colleen Stan case. What do you think was going through the, I'm sure she's kind of answered this question, so maybe you'll know, but, you know, what's going through the mind there as she escapes, then just waits 3 months and keeps talking to this guy? Clearly she was very confused.
Yeah, and I think it is, confusion about the relationship and what, the attachments were. I think with Colleen Stan, too, is when she went to court, she was, because she was used as a sex slave, when she went to court, she was actually told to tone her appearance down. Because she was still highly sexualized, because that's all the focus she'd had for such a long time. So I think, I avoided using the Stockholm syndrome because it was just so hard to define what it was. Because if you're kidnapped, you're going to want to do anything you can to survive. If they say do something or I'll kill you, you'll do it. You saw that with Lee Howe, the women would kill each other in order to survive. If they had to perform sex acts in order not to be beaten or murdered, they would do it. So I sort of avoided using Stockholm syndrome, though a lot of it often came up during the research, but I couldn't find it's not in the DSM for, so I sort of avoided using it for that reason as well, because it could sort of just be one of those things could easily, you know, attributed to many things. And I've read other people saying, you know, about domestic things that they had Stockholm syndrome. And so it was a bit hard to find out where the borders of Stockholm syndrome was. And that's what I, for me. So I think, you know, if you're in a situation and you need to survive, I think that you'd just do whatever you needed to in order to survive. The relationship, I think, you know, humans, the people who are taken captive have, you know, probably got a lot more empathy than they do, you know, than their captors do. So they're probably going to feel something. I don't know. It's difficult to tell what goes through the mind of someone unless, you know, you're in that situation. So.
Yeah, exactly. I'm sure it's sort of earth-shattering in a way where you're the only person you've known for years and years and years. How you break out of that? You know what I'm saying? It's if you're that captive, and the only person you know is maybe the dude or the dude and his wife or, you know, their family, and you're being held captive by them. It's how do you break out of that? That's the challenge in a way.
Yeah, that's part of your life then, isn't it? And it's also going to be part of the way that the world views you as well. So it's sort of, you know, every mark leaves its trace. So, you know, something's going to stick, something's going to remain. So there's always, you know, whether it's hatred or a liking someone, it's going to remain. So it's, very difficult to know what's going through their minds, so.
Absolutely, yeah. But in a way, too, it's a real testament to the indomitable nature of the human spirit with a lot of these cases, especially that Colleen Stan case, but also the case from India, the girl held for 25 years. I mean, these people, they survive. That's amazing. You know, it's really, in a way, it's the silver lining from the whole book, in a sense. It's that these, most of these folks make it. Most of these folks come out of the situation and you know, rebuild a life, which is awesome.
Yeah, some of them do. They rebuild life. Others don't. They haven't been very, you know, come out very scarred from the...
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, from the ordeals, of course. Yeah, so many of them do rebuild their lives and done quite well. And some of them, especially Elizabeth Smart, who we didn't cover, but that's, she's quite well known. And, she managed to, you know, form, you know, build a, you know, a very solid life, around the outcome of her ordeal and managed to move on, quite remarkably with the support of the Mormon community. So that was, and same J.C. DeGard, you sort of see interviews with them and you think, God, you know, you people are so clear-headed and, you know, able to understand. We've got great complexity about, you know, all these people who you're with and your situation and, you know, very articulate. So, yeah, it's quite good to when that occurs.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And you did kind of remind me, yeah, the Cleveland case in a way almost was sort of like the crescendo of these other cases that led up to it, you know, the J.C. DeGard and the Elizabeth Smart. It's like this has been kind of making the news a lot in the last decade or so here in America. So it's sort of the awareness of the phenomenon is growing.
Yeah, completely. I don't think people are going to forget the Cleveland case, you know, anytime soon. So
yeah, that was like a textbook case. It was almost, in a way, like I said, it was almost like the universe winking at you, saying, "Hey, we know good job on the book," because it's like that case could have fit seamlessly into this book. It's exactly the kind of stuff, you know. When I was telling people what
All right.
I was doing the show about today, the easiest way to sum it up is, you know, like those girls in Cleveland. It's like the textbook version of this phenomenon.
Yeah, I chose not to. I didn't want to wait to put the book out because a lot of the cases, I knew that this was going to be a big case, the Cleveland one.
Yeah, that was going to take six months.
Proof to come in.
Yeah.
And, but that could, you know, when big cases happen, I think for the first few hours, you get the truth, or you get, you know, just information. And particularly these days, you know, after the first few hours of the first day or so, you start getting more opinion or conjecture coming through, and things get quite muddled, and misinformation is being put over the internet or through news channels, and then that can just take months or even up until the point of the court case to finally find out what exactly did occur. A lot of books you sort of see someone has written, and, you know, this case only happened like a month ago. I think there was one with the Cleveland one, and it came out, and it was only like a month or two afterwards. And it was, how do you know what happened? It's too quick. It's too soon. You don't know what's fact and what's fiction at this stage and what's opinion. So I think you've got to be careful. And, that's why writing the book, I was sort of, short but dense, just give information over. If you want to make opinions about the case, then, that's your choice, and you can make them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like I said, the book's outstanding in the sense that you can really take little bite-sized pieces out of the book and enjoy, or for lack of a better term, enjoy each of the stories, and they're really well put together. Like you said, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. There's sort of a lead up to the captivity. There's the events of the captivity, and there's the fallout from the revelations of the captivity. Let's say so. It's a really
finding out
well
the sentences
done.
Of thank you. I do appreciate it.
I love the book, man. I told you I have a real fascination with this phenomenon. It's funny, you were talking about how sort of the Fritzl case led to this sort of obsession with the phenomenon. I keep calling it a phenomenon, but I guess that's probably the best way to put it, because it is a phenomenon of human nature, the captive human phenomenon. Having seen the Colleen Stan thing and then the Cleveland thing happened sort of right afterwards, it was like, I need to know more about this. So I was thrilled to find out about the book.
Yeah, and there hasn't been one for a while, so hopefully there's not one for a while. You might get a break from it.
Have you discovered any new cases since the book came out? Obviously, aside from the Cleveland one, has anything else popped up that you're like, oh, that would have been good for the book, or maybe one that you're looking into now?
The one in Texas, I thought was very interesting. It didn't get much media attention, but it's been pretty quiet. The smaller one, as I mentioned earlier, in China, I find that quite fascinating, that it's sort of a cultural thing, cultural element that, makes it almost acceptable. So, it's been a bit quiet on the captive humans front at the moment, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
No, and it speaks to the nature of the whole thing in a way where it's hard to explain. It's like a plane crash, it'll happen out of nowhere. I could hang up the phone right now and turn on the TV, and it'll be girl found in Philadelphia that had been held captive for 7 years. You're not going to see it coming at all. So it could happen at any moment.
You're not going to see which country it's going to come from, all the motivation behind it. It's only really, looking back at the in retrospect to see the people involved and go, there has been a lead up to this. It doesn't generally happen. It doesn't appear to happen just out of, one day someone just makes up their mind. There seems to be a whole history behind it, all the cases.
Now, I don't know if you've looked into this, but if folks aren't terrified and horrified by now by this phenomenon, I don't know what will make them be, but what troubles me, what sort of gnaws it in my mind in a way, is, and I would love it if you, I don't know what you're doing next, that's kind of like the setup here to what you're doing next, but you know what would be interesting is a look, because you just looked sort of at modern cases of this. I can only imagine the horrifying, frightening, unsettling, any word you want to use, nature of this phenomenon going further back in time when culture was different. Can you imagine the kind of things that might have happened in Renaissance England back in the day or anywhere else in the world in different eras, this clearly has been going on for a long, long time. So I would love it if you looked more into that eventually, but I don't want to.
Yeah,
I'm not your manager, so.
A lot of that hasn't been recorded, the historical cases. There was one, I think it was the Wolf Boy of Germany, and that was, I don't know if it was the 1600s or something, and that was just one that was so far back, and apparently he came out of being held in a, under a house for several years, and sort of, and it was unclear whether it actually occurred or not, or whether it was folklore, or whether it was based on, part here and part there of, actual cases, and they got put together over time. So, yeah, there'd be, things that I think just a lot wouldn't have been recorded a while ago, and or maybe it is, and we just need to find it.
Yeah, that's true, too. If it was culturally more accepted, then it wouldn't be titillating enough to record, in a sense. Do you know what I mean? If they were like, yeah, he kept his daughter captive for 25 years. That happens. That's the way it is. It's like, it wouldn't be a big deal to people, so they wouldn't write it down or record it back in the day.
Yeah, it was just the dumb thing, that the people may have just done it throughout Europe in those times. I mean, you remember the Stephen King book, Pet Cemetery, and their family had the deformed sister who lived up in the attic bedroom, and they kept her there the whole life, and it was just a family secret until she died. So, we don't know where else it's occurred.
Yeah. But as we said earlier, it's probably happening like all over the planet all the time right now. Well, not all the time, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's clearly happening.
And also,
right now.
And also we're only hearing about sort of from countries that, some more westernized countries, a lot of them. Different countries of South America, especially with human trafficking and throughout Africa and other parts of Asia, those aspects, I didn't explore those at all, because I'm sure there's cases for different cultural reasons that are occurring that we aren't, that we just aren't privy to. So
yeah,
it'd be interesting to look at, a broader scope as well, to see what else could come out of it.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's what I also liked about the book a lot, because, here in America, the news is very Americanized. Foreign stories, with the exception of the Fritzl case, which was so off the wall bizarre that it became like a story here in America, I hadn't heard about almost any of these international cases in the book. And as I said, 11 countries, folks, where this kind of stuff has happened. It's amazing.
Yeah, we're lucky in Australia because we digest a lot of international news. So we get a lot of it, particularly from America, but Europe and other places around the globe. So people are quite interested in global events in Australia. So you can have quite a broad scope. So we have heard of some of them, but that's what a number of people who read the book who just said they've just not heard of these cases before. So that was a fascinating bit, and that's hopefully for an audience. And for a reader, that's, hopefully that's my job done.
Yeah, man, you did an outstanding job on this book. Now, what's next for you? Do you have any plans to sort of continue in the true crime realm, and do you have a sort of topic that you might want to tackle next?
I'll probably update Captive Humans a little bit down the track. Not at the moment. At the moment, I'm working on a historical novel that's centered around my town of where I live, called Melbourne, and it's about sort of events that happened about a century ago, and it's one of those ones where I came across it, just a small article, and I was like, what? I never heard of this. And so, and then I sort of explored and found it was a much larger story. So, I'm doing a young adult novel based around events of 100 years ago in town. And when I mention it to people, they themselves, no one's heard of this stuff. And it's like it's all sitting on our back doors, but it's just covered in the past. So I just want to bring that up. So that's my main focus at this stage.
Okay. Now, I got to ask you here. I'm on the Captive Humans website, captivehumans.com. Tell me a little bit about this lady's handbook of murder, because that looks like a – I don't know if this is your work or if it's just –
No,
Okay.
That's one of my friend's work. I did the graphic design.
Okay, yeah, because the layout is so similar. I was like, oh, did you do all this too? Because this is awesome too. This is amazing.
That's my friend. So she was looking at murders throughout history. So, and but she sort of writes hers. I was more factual about the way I write, but she's more sort of does it more with a comedic slant with hers, and she looks at cases that aren't familiar as well. She doesn't sort of go straight into the Alan Wernos story, but looks at, you know, cases, you know, they're maybe 150 years old and explores those and sort of says, you know, the one happened in our hometown, and it's just like, well, I hadn't heard of this before as well. And so, yeah, so I, you know, that's my friend's work, and she's hopefully one day we'll release a book about it.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like I stumbled across a potential future edition of the show here with that website. So maybe I'll pester you for some contact info if she'd be down for a show.
Oh, sure, no worries.
Well, I gotta thank you, David, for coming on the show. I know the book came out a couple of years ago, and folks can get it pretty much anywhere. It is, of course, Captive Humans: True Crime Cases of People Held Captive. It is outstanding, folks. And as I said at the beginning of the program, as morose as it sounds, it's the perfect beach book right now for folks who are doing some traveling, because you can tackle the book in bite-sized pieces and digest each one of these really crazy stories. And as David said, and what I like to do, too, from reading the book is, you know, some of these cases stand out. It's like, that's an interesting one, this David Bisson case or the Kyle Ramirez case. You can kind of punch it into the Google and dig even deeper into it and delve even further into the stuff. So it's an amazing survey of these cases and a fantastically well put together book and just really, really, really strong stuff. So I can't thank you enough for coming on the show, David, and I really enjoyed the book quite a bit.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.